Hi, I'm Ben Collins, and welcome to Some Say, my podcast, which is all about fascinating automotive car stories. As some of you know, for many years, I was that guy in the white suit on Top Gear who didn't say much. But in this series, I'll be chatting to amazing guests from the world of cars and motorsport. In this episode, my guest is a Formula One driver who went missing. He was described by Eddie Jordan as the greatest racing driver of all time, an F1 champion who never was. It's my pleasure to welcome the renegade racer that is Tommy Byrne. Welcome, Tommy.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
It's such a pleasure to speak with you in your man cave as well, because I can see you've got some amazing stuff on the wall. Have you got any seat belts with that chair? You might need some.
No, this is my son's chair and my wife's threw me out of the house, so I ended up here.
Look, it's such a privilege to speak with you because I read your book, Crashed and Burned. The story is just amazing and I laughed out loud. I was nearly in tears and just got some insights into your career that I'd heard glimpses of going through my racing career with racing people like Glenn Waters and others that were observed what you were doing back in the day. I always wanted to meet you. You remember Glenn, do you? Okay. Did you ever race for him?
No, I did not. I think he was with, I think it was a green Formula 3 car he was working for at the time. It wasn't Dave Scott, was it? But I know Glenn was, Glenn was a good guy. I like Glenn.
Yeah, he's mega. Well, it's rare to get an opportunity to chat to an F1 driver and someone who's done the things that you did. We caught up before, and I was keen to sort of, I guess, follow up on what got you into motorsport. And I think we talked about you grew up on a farm, which I can relate to because I did too, and I was grabbing hold of any kind of machinery I could get hold of to sort of make it go. Is that sounded a bit like your upbringing?
Well, I grew up not far from a farm, and I worked at the farm for I think it was like a quarter or something per week. The guy's name was Pete Murphy, and the only reason I was at the farm is just to try and get to drive the tractor. And I think I started at like nine or 10 years of age, and I would do anything to drive the tractor, even though it was crawling speed at the time, picking up turnips and stuff like that. But I obviously always loved anything that would move.
Were you tall enough to get your boots on the pedals? Because I did that with a sit-on lawnmower when I was about four and I crashed it. I couldn't reach the brake.
Yeah. No, one of my biggest problems in racing all my life actually was my legs are pretty short. I'm short anyhow, but my legs are actually shorter than the rest of me. And one of the things we did was we used to put wooden pedals on some of the cars I drove. Yeah. It was easier just to put the wooden pedals on than change all the pedals because they had to be moved so far.
Didn't your feet slip off the pedals?
My foot slipped off the pedals once in an Anson, but we didn't have the wood on there at that time. And I was about to win the race, and it was wet in 1984, 83 it was. And Davy Jones beat me. I just ran wide at the chicane, and he beat me. So, yeah, my foot has slipped off the pedals before.
Yeah, that's crazy. I saw something else you'd said when you first got into racing and into Formula Ford, that you would go past people with the brakes on fire and the tires locked, which might not be the best way to stop, but it was effective for getting past people.
Yes, you read that in my book. When I started racing, when I went to Mondello and I actually did my first couple of races, everybody was trying to tell me what to do and give me advice, and obviously I didn't listen to any of them because I thought I was doing the right thing. I would dive down the inside of a car, I would hit the brakes as hard as I could, all four wheels would lock up, smoke would come off them, and I'd pass the guy, and I thought I must be doing okay because I got by. But it turns out that I was doing everything wrong, and they were just letting me by because they knew that I was just a crazy bastard and I was probably going to run into them.
So they were afraid of you, effectively. As a braking technique, that's early days, and you get better as you go on, don't you? You get a couple of years under your belt, and I always think every day is a school day. And you obviously pick things up very, very quickly. And braking, I think in particular, is such a crucial way of getting lap time. Was that critical to you getting the speed out of the cars you raced?
Well, it's just amazing. I don't even know what I did or how I did it at the time. But remember, I went to England in 1979. I had a works drive with PRS when I went over there for the first time ever. And I'm out there racing with, that's when we had heats and semifinals and stuff like that. And so we were all learning our craft. Roberto Moreno was driving, I was driving, and everybody was learning at the same time. And we were learning at Silverstone, Hockenheim, Nürburgring, the little Nürburgring. There was two of them. There was a little one, 2 mile, and then there was the big 17 mile. And so we were learning our stuff. We didn't even know I had no idea what I was doing, diving down the inside learning. But over the first year was a learning year, and then 1980 was when I went with Ralph Firman. I was a semi-works driver. that's when you start learning, you know, how to stay on the track and still not be locking up brakes, not do all that stuff. It's just crazy. If I had a kid now and I threw him out there with, you know, 30 other kids around Hockenheim or Nürburgring, I'd be shitting myself.
So for those that don't know what Formula Ford was like back in those days, I had a tiny taste of it. I was at the Formula Ford Festival in the 90s, but I know that back in the days when you were doing it, you would get a race weekend with maybe 100 cars entering, something like that, and they would whittle you down. You would do staged races, which were casually called heats, but they were full-on races to get to the final and then try and win. That's about right, isn't it?
Yeah, it was crazy. I was in Hockenheim with the PRS in 1979. I was never even was out of my country before 1979, and this is before the chicanes. This is like when there was no chicanes, and I'm Formula Ford 1600, and I think I might have been leading or second or third, going into one of the there was no big the big turn was still there, and I was braking for the first chicane. Four cars down came down the inside of me, and four cars come down the other side of me, and I just looked to my right and looked to my left, and it just scared the crap out of me, and I was in 10th place just like that. And then I got mad, and then I started learning how to do this draft or what slipstreaming, whatever the case may be. But I mean, that's the way it was. It was nuts.
So was that early on in one of the heats, and then by the time you got to the sort of the finals, you'd figured out the slipstreaming so you could draft up behind people and get past. You worked out the tactics.
Yeah, and then you get a double draft, and then depends on what gear ratio you have in. It depends on how many people are in front of you. So then you might have a 25, 26, or a 26, 25, or 25, 25 top gear. And that's the stuff you start learning in your second year of racing. It was very interesting, and it was just crazy driving, and I loved it.
So 1980 was your second year of racing, is that right?
1980 would be my second year in England racing, yes. And I was a semi-works driver, which means I got a free car from Ralph Firman Van Diemen, and I got a free engine from Auriga. And then I did the work on my car myself. And my friends, obviously, I had a lot of friends came help me. And that was my second year in racing.
So without spreading conspiracy theories and but having, you know, read a few books and things about you and Senna, and that around this time, Senna was looking to come to Europe and had been offered a drive in Formula Ford in 1980, but declined it. And I remember someone in the pit lane, well, he decided not to do Formula Ford in 1980 because he didn't want to race against Tommy Byrne. Or maybe it was the year after. I might be mixing up the stories, but is that a story you may have heard?
All I heard was that he was called Fast Man at the time. Ralph Firman would call him Fast Man because Chico Serra talked about the really fast driver coming over, and his name was Ayrton Senna or Ayrton de Silva at the time. And he was Fast Man. Fast Man, Fast Man. And he was supposed to come, but he couldn't come one year because of his dad. His dad wouldn't let him, or he was trying to say he was not driving or something like that. The other rumor came out in my book. Mark Hughes put it in that he didn't want to do Formula 3 with me the same year, but I have no idea what happened there.
No, exactly. So there was a but there was almost overlap because you did so 1980, you did Formula Ford, you won the championship that year as well.
Two championships.
But you did Formula Ford Festival, but finished second.
Finished second to Roberto Moreno in the festival? Yes.
Well, you let Moreno in for one, which was very noble to let someone else win for a change. But what happened in that final?
I didn't let him win that race. I tried to beat him in the final, but I just couldn't get to him. I was in. He had Patch, and Patch is the special engine you get to win the festival. Whoever gets Patch usually wins it. And I knew it was going to be tough, so I finished second in every race. Roberto won every race, and that was the end of that. It was next year when I won it with Patch in Ayrton Senna's car when he retired.
You need to tell everybody what Patch actually is, because nobody outside of the Formula Ford legend knows.
Well, I think it was around from Trevor Van Rooyen in 1977. I think he was one of the first people to have it. And basically, the slipstreaming we were talking about, a car will get up behind you get more speed, and you pull it at the last moment, and you pass. And you can pass two or three cars like that. Patch was so strong, nobody was ever able to even slipstream Patch. So whoever had that engine was guaranteed to win the race, especially on the faster tracks. It was crazy good.
The name Patch, I was told, is because the piston blew out the side of the block and it was repaired.
Yes.
So potentially the engine, when it was repaired, had a bigger displacement and it was freer inside and it could run a bit quicker.
It was just a really, really good engine, and there was a hole in the side of it, and they repaired it. That's what was called Patch. But as it turns out, years later, there was a couple of patches.
Yeah, and there was Son of Patch.
There was Patch and Son of Patch, yeah, but the original Patch was the one you needed.
Yeah, so that was difficult. So Formula Ford Festival, super tight. Then the next year you did Ford 2000, which was the level up, yep. Slicks and wings and that kind of thing.
I was a works driver for Ralph Firman then. So basically I had a mechanic, and I think with Dave Meehan was my mechanic at the time. No, Putty. Putty was my mechanic. And we did the European. We did the European Formula Ford 2000 Championship, and we did the British, and I won both of them.
So at this stage, having raced for a few years and you got to that level, and you were consistently at the front and winning and setting the paces in qualifying. Back in those days, you had no data telemetry and you didn't have people outside with stopwatches, presumably telling you where you were quicker or slower like they do these days, right, to develop people. So, and I get the impression you were a very instinctive driver. You're self-taught. But as part of that, at that stage, did you have a fairly deep understanding of what you were doing that was quicker than other people?
I started learning about the car with Ralph Firman. That's my really first teacher. What it takes to corner weights. You know, at the time, Ralph had the old corner weights where he used to weigh potatoes on them. So he had four of those and he put the car on there. And Ralph believed in me as well, which makes a big difference if you have a team owner that believes in you or a team engineer. So I learned a lot from Ralph, a lot of stuff going on there. And we spent, I think we must have done 50 or 60 test sessions over like in 1 year. So okay. We would be testing at Snetterton a lot. Sometimes it was like 9 and 10 o'clock at night. It was nearly dark. So you talk about data. We changed the car. We changed something on the car, and I go out and I would just take a look at the revs coming off the turn, and if the revs were different, picked up or dropped off, I'd know that it worked or it didn't work. And then so I was really good at that, and I had a really good feel. But not only that, everybody in the pits, like a Ralph Firman or a Gary Anderson or any of those guys at that time, there's only one car on the track. And you did a change to the car, they could tell the difference because they could listen and know straight away, oh, it's worked or it didn't work. And if it didn't work, I just pull in straight away and try something else.
Yeah. And so, and through the year though, learning different tracks, that all, again, did you get a chance to test it everywhere, or did you just adapt your style to each one?
Well, obviously Monaco, you can't get the test, and that hurt me because I crashed when I got to Monaco in the first session. I was really, always really good at learning tracks. Yes, for sure. It would take me probably 3 or 4 laps, and like a normal track, not like the Nürburgring was a little bit tougher. And then I was very good at learning tracks and learning conditions. Whereas now today when I drive, now it takes me a long time to learn a track.
All right. Well, here's a question for like an honest question. So because it's learning tracks to say that that you didn't miss anything in those first 5 laps and then honestly come through the weekend and think, actually, on lap 25 or whatever, you unpick some small piece of detail, something tiny that's worth a 10th of a second. Do you think that that's fair to say with you as well?
Absolutely, for sure. I mean, we think we learned everything on the first session or the second session, or whatever, but then the more you go to that turn or that track or whatever, there's certain little things you pick up here and there. Absolutely, yeah. There's no question. But we were still on the pace. It wasn't just me. It was me, Roberto Moreno, Fernando, there was another guy over there, I forget his last name, and they were all pretty good. Basically, there's no excuse for you go to a track, and if somebody says, yeah, but he was never at that track before, that wasn't an excuse back in the day.
So who were the main rivals in Ford 2000 in that year in 81?
Actually, in Ford 2000, David Coyne was probably one of them. Mike Fulmer-Taylor was one of them. David was there. It wasn't a lot, but they all had different cars as well, different type cars. And I didn't realize that Dave Coyne was as good as he was. And I just thought that he had a better car than me if he beat me. But it was still tough. I mean, we weren't throwing money at it. It was a budget for Ralph. But Ralph knew I'd always win the race. Like my very first race I did in Formula Ford 2000, I was at Brands Hatch and I qualified 10th. And my mechanics from 1600 were laughing at me. I think it was Dave Meehan actually, and Adrian, whatever. And I said, don't you worry, I'll be leading the race, or I'll be right up front by paddock, and I wave to you. So I'm coming up the paddock. I got a hell of a start because I love the starts, and I'm going. I think I was either going around the outside of somebody for second or for first at paddock, and I remember those guys in the grandstand, and I put my hand up like that, my right hand, and I waved at them. So I just. Loved it. I love standing starts.
What's your trick for getting off the line quickly?
I don't know. All I knew was I did it. Most of the time I did it right. In those days you didn't hold it flat on the rev limiter. In those days you had to do both. You had to rev it up and let the clutch out just at the right time as you were coming back with the gas. It wasn't just hold it and go. So I don't know, but most of the time I got it right.
So you had half power on with the Ford 2000, and is that probably the same in F3 in that era?
All of it. None of the cars I drove, you could hold it flat on the rev limiter and let it out. It was always a little bit of both.
So a good feeling on the clutch. And then, yeah. So was it in that time, was there anybody that you would be racing with that you'd think there's a good chance this guy will take me out? Either in Ford or 2000, where it would be a slugging match. I don't know if it was more polite in those days or whether you would get wheel banging and all that stuff carrying on.
No. I didn't care about anybody taking me out, but we all ran into it. That's what the goal was, to stay in front no matter what. That's just the way it was. And you'd see the guy coming behind you. You knew he was going to draft you. So you'd think to yourself, okay, he's going to draft me to the right, and I'm going to pretend to go to the left. I'll block to the left because he's going to go to the right. And then you think, wait a minute, though. Then when you're coming behind, you double look. You think two ahead. Well, he's going to go to the right because he thinks I'm going to go to the right, but I'm going to go to the left. So you're always thinking like that. But the goal was, whoever, if you're in front, nobody got by you. You just kept them behind no matter what, run them off the grass. We crashed so many times, and that's just Formula Ford 1600 in the day.
It sounds like you were a prime thug. So was there much tapping going on around the top toe links and stuff like that?
You just played chicken with the one beside you. If there's somebody beside you, you're coming along like this trying to touch them, they wouldn't be touching much because in 1600, both of you are going to be up and off the track. But it was just he who wanted to stay in front the best stayed in front the best.
So did you have any big shunts back in the Formula Ford days? Because it was always close that, wasn't it?
I had one at Mallory. I went, somebody put me off the track at Mallory, and I ran into one of the corner worker stands in 79. Then I had one in Ireland where I hit a gas pole. That was pretty hard. I hurt my knee. That's the only injury I ever had in racing.
One of the things that impressed me is that when you're doing Ford 2000, you dominated Ford the year before, but then you go up a level with the higher levels of grip. But you went back down a category to the Ford Festival, which I think is extremely hard to do when everyone's just done the whole season, and then you won that festival. So
I went down a category, James Weaver went down a category, and Rick Morris went down a category. All three of us did the same thing for that race. And we finished first, second, and third.
So when I was watching that race, it was interesting. That was my first race weekend, was the Ford Festival. And I was surprised that, firstly, I got breathalyzed coming out of the cafeteria, which was a surprise to me at age 19. And I wouldn't even have thought that you'd try and race anything but sober. So that was curious.
It's a good job we didn't get breathalyzed.
That's what I heard. I also heard that that a lot of the guys on the grid, especially a lot of the Irish boys, would fold the mirrors in on the grid for the final, which as a kind of way of saying, I don't care what's happening behind, I'm staying in front.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but I know that in Mondello, people have been known to have a couple of drinks before the race. In Mondello, in England, it never happened, that I know.
No.
But I know in Mondello Park, it did happen.
Yeah, but the racing was phenomenal.
That Formula Ford 1600, that... the festival that I won, I won four championships. And Senna obviously retired, and Ralph Furman asked me to drive his car and in the festival. I said, sure, no problem. With Patch, it's a no-brainer. Well, it turned out a no-brainer, I'm going to win it, easy. And it turns out that it was not easy at all. Rick Morris was behind me all the way in the semifinal and the final, and he was so close behind me. Do not look in the mirror. Once a lap, when past the start finish, and I looked, he was there. I put my head down, concentrated, and did it again for 14 laps out of 15. And he made a mistake on the paddock with one lap to go. And I just went, shit, thanks, thank God for that. And I won it. I would never have got to Formula One if I did not win that race. My career possibly could have been over very quickly. And that was the biggest race win of my career, because that's when I got the free Formula 3 ride in Thruxton the week after, and I finished second in that. And that's when Murray Taylor decided, hey, this guy's pretty quick. We're going to find the money for him to go Formula 3. It would never have happened. That race was the biggest race that I won, even though I won four championships before that.
It's huge pressure, isn't it? And I think with brands, especially going the paddock hill corner, because it's so wide going in and the way it drops down, there's lots of different lines there. And that decision of whether you defend and then you're going to get choked up and more people will come after you, or whether you swing it wide and take the fastest line.
You just can't make a mistake. When you're in front like that, the hardest thing to learn as a racer is to lead the race from start to finish with somebody a couple of feet off your ass without making a mistake. That's the hardest thing to learn in racing. And I did it a lot, but it never gets any easier.
Because they've got less to lose, and you've got everything to lose. Yeah,
yeah. It's easier following the car than the guy in front has to pick his braking points precisely and no mistakes. And you can't stop blocking, because you start blocking and then everybody else catches up. So it's a very hard thing to do. But if you can do that, I think you can be a race-winning, championship-winning driver.
So after 2000, then you also in that year, I think you did an F1 F3 race, which you finished second in, which is also pretty awesome.
F1, F3, which one was that?
So 1981, you did a one-off F3 race, then you went up to F3 for 1982. And in that series, again, was it very tight?
I had Martin Brundle, I had James Weaver, I had Roberto Moreno. I had a really tough championship compared to Senna the year later, had one person, that was Martin Brundle. I had all of them. They were all really good. I mean, Weaver was good, Moreno was great. Brandon was great on his day. I mean, everybody, they were all pretty good.
So you had a tough year of F3, but you still won a hell of a lot of races.
I got lucky. I just got, well, I mean, when I won them, they didn't win. So for championship wise, I was always ahead. And then I went to do Formula One for those couple of races. And I missed three Formula 3 races, and I still was able to come back. I think I won it by 1 point.
When was your first F1 test?
I think it was in Alton Park.
Bloody hell. Yeah. I'm just trying to picture Formula One car at Alton Park, the tight and twisty roller coaster track with no chicane.
I don't know at the time. I don't think there was a chicane then, because it was 1982. And then I did a couple of days, a one day testing at Snetterton. And Russell was pretty interesting in that car. So remember, you're coming from a Formula 3 car with 140 horsepower to a big, heavy Formula 1 car at a 500 horsepower, that particular car. And it was interesting, especially when I didn't qualify the Formula 1 car and I'd fly home and I'd do Formula 3 the next day. It was very, very different. It was like the little bicycle wheels on the front of the Formula 3 car.
Who was your first F1 test with, though?
It was Theodore. It was just the first team I drove Formula 1, Theodore.
So you started with them, but then you won the championship, and that's when you got a test with McLaren. Is that how that worked?
I got the test with McLaren because I won the Formula 3 championship, and the first three drivers got the same test. It was 25 laps each, and it was the same for a couple of years, the year before and the year after. I think they did it for 5 years. Marlboro was the sponsor.
Who were you up against on the test day then?
The day I was there was Thierry Boutsen, and I think Mansilla got in the car after that. So yeah. Boutsen was first, I was second, and then Mansilla was third.
At Silverstone GP track, is that right?
Silverstone GP track, yes.
Yeah. So can you remember your times and their times from that, or was that too long ago?
No, I remember it. I remember it like it was yesterday. I did a 10. Thierry Boutsen did a 1 minute 10.9, was as fast as after putting on new tires, because everybody got new tires, I think, after 10 or 15 laps or something. And
what time did he run?
He did a 1 minute 10.9.
In the morning, or like, when was this?
It was just, it would have been in the morning, I think, because it takes about half hour to change the pedals by the time. So I might have got in the afternoon, not too sure, but he did a 10.9. And then I already did a 10.9 in my old tire before putting new ones on. And then my last three laps were 10.1, 10.1, 10.1. They were all exactly the same for whatever reason.
Yeah. And Mansilla, he was slower again.
Yeah, but then in retrospect, thinking about it, I mean, he had no chance. Like, Boutsen was a Formula 2 driver, so he was used to driving, you know, fast cars. Mansilla never drove a Formula 1 car at all, and I really did get a bit of a jump because I drove some Formula 1. So just was a matter of getting into a better car, which was the McLaren was the best car on the grid at the time.
What was that like getting in I suppose it wasn't your first taste of an F1, but still, when you jump from Formula 3 to that, what is that like in that era?
When I drove the Formula 1 car for the very first time, I was in, I think, Snedden it was, right? So I'd be leaving the garage and I'm turning right. So you sit so far forward. I was sitting so far forward, I got on top of the front wheels nearly. And then when I was turning right to come out of the garage, I thought, shit, the back tire is going to hit the wall when I turn. That's the feeling I got at that time. But of course, once you do it a couple of times, you don't, the feeling goes away. But that's the very first feeling I got, because we sat in front of it. We sat right on the tires back in that day. You could touch the tires with your hands.
But physically as well, I mean, at Silverstone, which is a high downforce track, that's going to be brutal.
Silverstone in the McLaren, I could have done a whole race. There wasn't a, it was no problem whatsoever. Now, Oldenburg, yes. Dijon, absolutely. We're going the wrong way. Vegas was really hard, because everybody's going the opposite. We're going left instead of right at Vegas. And it's 100 degrees. And I think everybody had trouble, even the guys that won the race in those days at Vegas. But obviously, I was good at Hockenheim. You need some time to drive a Formula One car and to be able to go flat out for the whole race with 300 pounds of fuel in the car. Yeah, it takes time to get used to it. But nobody was doing a lot of work on that in those days. That started later on with Schumacher, I think, was the main guy that started really, really physically working out. Yeah, we didn't do much of the work. We did enough, but I was pretty strong, my upper body. Roberto was struggling, Moreno, because he was just a little guy. But my upper body was strong. And yeah, just another, it would have taken another few races to get, you know, to get to where you want to be. But some of the try, as I said, the McLaren was so easy to drive. There was no problem at all around Silverstone.
Going back to that test, though, is that right? I read that, well, firstly, you'd driven it, those lap times were quicker than the race drivers had ever gone in it around that track. Is that correct? Quicker than Lauda's time at Silverstone.
Yeah, but again, Lauda was there the week before and it was kind of a little bit wet. But remember,
Different day.
we didn't do qualifying tires. We just did the C compound for that test.
Yeah.
We used to put qualifying tires on in those days, which were 3 to 4 laps a lap, 3 to 4 seconds a lap quicker.
The bit that I do remember is that is the story that they pushed your throttle stop in to prevent you getting full throttle. Is that a true story?
Yes, that's true. I didn't know that until 20 years after the fact. At the time when I drove the car, I didn't think nothing of it. I didn't feel anything. All I know is, in retrospect, thinking back on it, I went to fourth gear going through the chicane instead of third.
Yeah.
Obviously, I must have done that by, I must have done it because I felt, well, I can't go any quicker than third, so I just went straight to fourth. And then I was doing cops in fourth, so I just adjusted like that. But it was 20 years later that Tony Van Dungen, the mechanic that was there, with, I think Scott, Mark Scott was the other one. He said, "Tommy, we, you know, what happened? How'd you do? You've been gone for all these years. What are you doing now? Daddy, daddy, daddy. Man, you were so fast in that car, the McLaren that day." I said, "Yeah, but no, there you go." And he goes, "Yeah, you weren't even in the quickest car." I said, "Well, Thierry Boutsen just got out of the car, and I just got into it. Pedals were fitted in the factory beforehand." He goes, "Yeah, but we were told not to give you full throttle." So I went, "Well,
That's terrible.
it was like." It was just something I didn't even think about McLaren doing something like that. I just the last thing on my mind was that would happen, or that they would give me the wrong times, which they did, because one of my guys, Joey Greenham, was there, and he came out, "Tommy, you just did a 9.8 in your last lap. They're showing you 10.1," and that's when I put two and two together. I did 3 10.1s in a row. So yeah, they had it. I obviously pissed somebody off in McLaren. So.
So what did you do? Can you think of anything? I mean, I know you're quite a larger than life character in your racing days. And
I know what I mean, I know what I'd done, because when I drove the Theodore, the team manager spent all his time. Well, it was Joe Ramirez who was a team manager. He was a nice guy. And then there was the other guy, Julian Reynolds. They just spent all their time putting me down. I couldn't drive when I was driving for them in their own car. So I knew I had a test coming. So I told anybody that would listen, come to the test and you'll see if I can drive or not, you know, because you guys are just fucking wankers. And they just treated me like shit. And yes, and that was one of the things I did. Other than that, no, nah, I mean, I talked to Ron Dennis about driving for him because I had a contract with Ron Dennis. They had an option on my services. So before I drove the Formula One car, I had to go ask him to get out of the contract. And he advised me not to do a 3-year contract. And I went back to Randall's and they said, "3 years or nothing." I went back to Ron. He said, "We advise you not to do, you know, here at McLaren, we advise you not to do a 3-year contract." So I went back again, and the guys, at theater goes, 3 years or nothing. So what do you do? You know, and I went back and said, hey, it's 3 years or nothing. He said, well, you know, I said, do you have anything for me? He goes, no. And I said, would you? He said, no. So I knew that there was nothing for me at that test with McLaren. So it wasn't like I lost the McLaren drive. There wasn't, everybody who signed up and were on the radio told me that there's no seat available. But if they had to give me the right throttle and the right times, I mean, you never know. And there was no test driving in those days either. So I just quit. I said, okay, I'll just go to America. At least I knew it was quick.
Did you ring around the other teams, anything like that?
No.
And try and smash it? You didn't?
I was never very good. Eddie Jordan signed me up as a management contract for me to drive Formula 3 for one more year in Europe with him, with COS sponsorship and Yokohama Tires. And he said, just hang on for another year, Tommy. And I think Eddie might have called one or two, but I think, was it the candy? What's the candy called? Tyrrell. Ken Tyrrell wanted, I think, £1 million to drive. So in, it just wasn't going to happen, you know? But I wasn't very good at calling, and it didn't, you know. I didn't even think about calling anybody or calling Ron Dennis or you know, Frank Williams or anybody like that. Just didn't, and I didn't have a manager. I had people help me, but not real, you know, real manager.
So if we were giving top tips to aspiring young racing drivers, so one is don't call everybody a wanker. Number two, I think, is you got to get on the phone more and hustle for the drives, do you think, regardless how good you are?
At least on the phone, or if you don't get on the phone, I mean, even in the day, the email or the Twitter and all that, there was none of that stuff, but at least get in touch with them. And it's easier to get a no on an email than it is, you know, on the phone. But I said, sure. You just have to keep asking if you want it bad enough. I obviously didn't want it bad enough to do that. I was more interested in getting out of there and getting to America.
Well, it's F1's loss. It would have been fascinating to see more of you in action. But I think. What about on track now, and how fast are you now today? Put you out in something. What can you do?
Well, I drove James Hagan, my friend from Northern Ireland, Hagan Holmes. I drove his car, Mondello, the James Hunt car, the Heskett. I did pretty good up against a young guy in a Formula 5000 car. Obviously, I'm not as quick. I'm not stupid. Anybody who's, except Alonso, anybody who's 41 is not as quick as the 23-year-old anymore. That's what I used to think until last weekend. Yes, you can be. Once you get to 60, 65, it's, you know, I'd be a decent long distance driver. But I'm pretty sure that, you know, I don't have the self-belief that I used to have. But I know now I have to learn. I have to learn stuff now that I didn't have to learn then. I just picked it up. Now you have to work harder. I have to work harder being fast now.
So who do you think is the best driver in F1 at the moment?
I mean, you have to look at Max, because even though it's pretty boring, just like it was with Lewis Hamilton, for all those years, he's winning everything. Everybody gets fed up with it. He's still a really great driver. But think back to when he was 17, what he did, you know. I would say he's probably one of the best drivers in Formula 1, or the best driver. George Russell's good. There's a lot of good ones now.
I agree with you. There's a lot of great fresh blood in F1. There's a lot of talent, and it's a golden era for competition.
And it's the same in Indy cars as well. I mean, it's so tight. And I guess a lot of it started from when they started having the paddle shifts. You know, once you start getting paddle shifts and getting the cars closer, it's a little bit easier to, and then all the testing and the simulators, it's a lot easier to, it's hard to pick that one guy, the Senna or the Verstappen out of the group anymore, because there's a lot of them on the way up.
Do you not think, so with Verstappen, it's an interesting one. That overtaking style that he has developed, for instance, is just different. I think a lot of drivers just hadn't necessarily thought to push people's limits to that extent when you go past them. And he puts these moves on that are so late on the brakes.
I just know that years ago when you'd be trying to follow the car in front, you're losing some of your downforce, you're losing some of your horsepower. And nobody could overtake. You get to a car that's in front of you, is a second lap slower than you, couldn't get by him, or 2 seconds, you couldn't get by. And then here comes Verstappen, and he just drives right by them. So that's just, you know, you're 100% right. He definitely is a better overtaker than a lot of people. Well, Alonso's pretty good too.
Who would you steal from IndyCar to put in Formula 1 at this time?
We kind of nearly have to be either Pillow or maybe Herta. Now, one of the young, maybe Pato Ward. I mean, there's a couple of good, there's two or three good guys there, young guy. IndyCar is so difficult, so hard now because of the whole field is less than a second sometimes, and you're a couple of tenths off and you're in the middle of the pack. And then one little mistake, I would say it's the most competitive racing in the world.
I think it is. Another one I would love to add to that list is Scott Dixon. So he was my teammate back in the day, and he's a huge talent, and he just is unstoppable.
Yeah, Scott is he's an awesome driver. Yeah. Ganassi is probably one of my favorite teams.
Scott's super versatile. I think that's what you were saying about that intuitive skill to be able to learn tracks quickly and adapt. It's just, yeah, I'd love to see him.
You've been to Elkhart Lake, right?
I haven't, no. What's it like?
Elkhart Lake, there's a turn there, it's called the Kink. It's one of the only turns in the world that hasn't been changed, to make it safer. And Scott Dixon was driving through there sideways, like opposite lock, full opposite lock in the Kink. And when I seen that, I just went, wow, the guy's pretty impressive.
Yeah. He's also one of the I know you engineer your own luck, but he's one of those guys that will always find a way through a sticky situation. He will always make his own luck and make things work.
He's been doing it for so long now. He's really good at just watching what other people are doing and what he needs to do. And sometimes he'll bring it home just for with the points to win the championship. So he's definitely for somebody who borrowed the money to get to where he is, it was a big gamble for him, and it worked.
Tommy, you've been in motorsport for a very long time, and you've been around it and watching it for decades. So if you're trying to pick out who is the best driver of all time, what are your thoughts on that?
You can't really pick the best driver of all time. It would have to be maybe who's the best driver for those 10 years, or who's the best driver for the next 10 years, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, 90s, 2000, 2010, 2020. That's just you have because the cars change. But then you obviously had Senna, you had Schumacher, now you got Verstappen. You had people, come out of the, like, you had just people come on gangbusters, and then they're good for years and years with the right car. And
Yeah.
but you can't just say that Max is better than Schumacher or Senna because they never race against each other. But I would say just from decade to decade, more than anything.
But I bet you have a favorite.
Max actually was my favorite, but now it's getting boring. So now I have to switch to Alonso. I was pulling for Alonso all weekend. I get up every morning. I get up and I go over to my friend's house across the road, and I'll get the three of us and we'd watch Formula One. And we'd be arguing, fighting over it, and drinking our mimosas. And
Yeah.
I pick, I'll pick. We all were going for Alonso, because it's something different. I'm not as angry as I used to be about this guy's the best and that. I really don't care anymore, but I do like to see a good race.
Yeah, who doesn't? So I've got one more question for you, which is around that era when you were doing your Formula Ford and 2000 and things like this. Because a lot of discussion around, for instance, Senna's driving technique. And this was in an era that you were dominant in, and he followed in your footsteps, really. And did you, I mean, you obviously had your style, which was very fluid and fast. I don't know how you would describe your approach to driving and dragging a time out of the car. But how would you compare your style of driving with Senna's?
See, I don't even know. I didn't know his style because I never got to Formula One with him. I guess when you get to Formula One, you have to start working a little bit harder on things, and I never really had to do that. It just happened for me. But my style was basically I did all the usual stuff, heel and toe, brake as late as possible as you possibly can, being in fully control at the apex and back to the gas. And of course, over the years, you got people out there now. You got everybody's a driver coach now. So you got everybody doing their own thing. You have to do it this way. You have to do it that way. It is what it is for certain people. Left foot braking, right foot braking. It depends on what car you're driving at the time, and what's faster. Is it faster? Is it not? I don't know. But as I said, now I have to work at it, whereas before I didn't. Now everybody's all talking about trail braking towards the turn. I've tried that 100 times. I always go back to the traditional way of just being back on the gas earlier at the
Yeah.
apex.
Did you ever get into squirting the gas at what would seem to be really inappropriate places, such as like the complex at Thruxton? There's a right-hander in there. And I had a teammate from South America called Brian Smith, an Argentinian driver. And I saw him do something on the data, which I would never have seen without it. You feel like a thief looking. And into the right-hander where it's super tight, second gear. and he went 100% throttle for just a microsecond and pulled a tenth of a second.
Well, that's what people are doing now. Obviously, when you have data and you get to look at it, then you start trying stuff. But back in the day, at the time, we didn't have that, so we didn't know. Somebody might be able to turn listening. But yeah, I can see now, if I seen something on data, yeah, I would like to try it, see if it works. Sometimes it works for some people, sometimes it doesn't. But the goal is always you have to wait for the front to grip before you go back to gas.
Yeah.
You have to, from the brake to the gas is critical. Like the younger drivers go from the brake straight to the gas. The older drivers go from the brake to the gas and the weight, one elephant, two elephant, go. So when we get older, we're too smooth. And when we're younger, there's a fine line in there. And it's the great drivers can find the fine line from coming off the brake to going to the gas. Some people do left foot brake and then they hit the gas at the same time. There's a lot of different ways, especially if you have data. But it was kind of cool when we didn't have data because everybody had to figure it out for themselves. I did drive James Hagan's LMP2 car as well, which is the Orica. I think it would be the open cockpit, which is what, 2000 model or something. And there's carbon fiber brakes on it. I did have a hard time figuring the brakes out. Because again, as you said, we talked about this. I don't get as much time in the cars anymore. But with the carbon fiber brakes, you have to hit the brakes 100%. And that 100% and then figure out how to get where you're going. But the main thing is 100% braking. If we did that, you know, years ago, you just lock the wheels up and run off the track. And another story I have, actually, I was up at West Palm Beach about 3 or 4 years ago, and I drove the Rotmans, the 962 Rotmans, the most famous one in the world. And the mechanic told me it was worth, be careful, Tommy, that's worth $2 million. And it turns out it was $15 million it was worth. So I got to drive that car along to Malcolm Ross around the track. Then I drove the Senna McLaren, which was the road car. Oh, not the road car, the Senna McLaren track car. Malcolm Ross had that one as well. Then I was walking through the paddock and I seen a Benetton over there. And the guy that owns the IndyCar team now, his name is Hollinger. He just bought into one of the IndyCar teams, and he had the Moreno's Benetton Schumacher one at the time, 191. And he said, "Do you want to drive it?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, I'll jump into it." And so I got into that Benetton for 9 laps. And the first couple of laps, I was lifting off the gas at the 4 mark, and the car just came to a stop. Yeah. There was so much downforce. And then the second lap, every time I came up to the car should have been with a real driver in Formula One in the day, they'd be breaking at 1. Well, I still was breaking at 2. And it was just unbelievable, the difference in the downforce from when I drove the Formula One cars. But that was pretty cool. And one day I got to drive all those 3 different cars.
That's mega. So if I get across the mid-Ohio, would you give me a lesson sometime?
Sure. Absolutely. I do. I still spend a lot of time up in mid-Ohio. I've been there now for 29 years.
All right, sweet. Well, I'll head out there and we'll see if you still got it and see if I've still got it.
Yeah, right. We can do that.
Thank you, Tommy. It's been amazing speaking to you. Thank you for sharing some of your speed secrets and your great stories.
Thanks, Ben.